What's going on, everybody? You're back with the Real Bodybuilding Podcast, and I'm here with the newest Olympia winning coach, Mr. Matt Jansen. How are you, sir?
What's up? How are you?
Good, man. This is a long time coming. I've wanted to have you on the show because, you know, I like to get the top coaches on, and you've now become, I think you've kind of like vaulted yourself into that upper echelon of coaches with this latest win. Not that you weren't there before, but this definitely like puts you there. So
yeah, thank you. I mean, it's been so surreal. Like, honestly, I mean, I've just had this goal for so long that I wanted to achieve, and how it happened and who it happened with, and just the whole week that we had together. I mean, we could talk a long time just about that, but the whole thing's just been like, I felt like this huge burden, like self-induced burden, kind of just released from me. Now, obviously, we're now on the other end of the spectrum where, you know, we need to hold the title now, and that's the goal. But it's really been incredible. Like, I can't thank everybody enough for the support that they've given me through this. You know, this was a dream come true for both of us. So it's been awesome.
When you say there's a burden you wanted to release, I don't know how many coaches expect to win the Olympia, but was something that was like on your shoulders?
Yeah. I mean, that's been the reason. I mean, ultimately one of the reasons why I've done this from the beginning is I wanted to win that, you know, the biggest title you could win in bodybuilding. Like that's what I've wanted to do.
Yeah. So you've had that ambition from the beginning. Cause I mean, it's crazy. A lot of people that start coaching that have a passion for it, want to make their clients great, and they want to have a big roster, and they want to help people win. But they're the first person I've actually heard say, I wanted to win an Olympia.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely did, you know, and I think too, like, I know we just discussed this. I feel like each coach is given their moment in time. And then from that point on, like it's up to that coach to what they do at the moment. And I felt like a lot of my moment might've been with Dallas.
Yeah.
You know, and then for a long time, like I felt this void. Like I felt like, obviously, first and foremost, Dallas was so much more than just a competitor to me, but the potential that he possessed, I never really knew if I was going to get that again, you know, and now like, I honestly feel blessed. I have that on several accounts. You know, I know that you and Nick have gotten a good relationship. Yeah. Nick has come into my life like a lot, like a Dallas figure. Like, Nick and I do bodybuilding because it's what we love, but like in the background, like what people don't see is just a relationship that we have, like how caring, you know, that's something else I want to say. Like, Nick has a heart of gold.
I know.
And I want people to really be able to see that side of him. I mean, there's very few people that ask how Matt's doing. And Nick is always one of those people. He's always checking on me, always checking on my family. So I kind of got on a, you know, subcategory there, but yeah so I felt this, like, I've always been very hard on myself, you know, even, and I'll just be really transparent. Like, this last summer, I was actually in the car with my wife. We had just gotten back from my appointment at the doctor where I was told that my pec was completely torn off.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't gone back into our home yet. And I was crying in our driveway, you know, and I was just basically telling my wife, like, I've always had this desire to be a champion. And I feel like I've always just fallen short, you know? I mean, even like, In college, my goal was to always be a collegiate athlete. I accomplished that goal, and then I got injured in college, and that was taken from me. You know, and then I've had this goal so long to turn pro in bodybuilding, and I felt like I was like right there knocking on the door, and then I tear my pec. You know, but I've, again, like, another thing that's happened over the past few weeks is I just have this sense of relief. Like, what I've accomplished with Sean, I know I personally can't accomplish the level that we just accomplished as a team.
Yeah.
So it's kind of taken away this like feeling inside me that I have to go pro, because even me going pro, I ultimately, in my hierarchy of what I view, I still view Sean's title better than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So it's been awesome on several different accounts.
Wow. You touched on a whole bunch of different things. So the first thing I want to do is, I want to go back and share everybody who we're talking about, because there's actually a lot of people that watch this show that aren't hardcore bodybuilding fans. So the first thing I want to do is share your page. This is Matt Jansen's Instagram. Follow Matt Jansen 8. This is a lot of your coaching stuff is on here. Now, this is Sean Clarita, who we're talking about. For those of you who don't know, he just won the 212 Olympia this past Olympia that just went by. And the interesting thing about Sean is he started at, like, when did you, how long have you been working with Sean?
We started in May of 2016.
May of 2000. So you've been with him for 4 years now. Sean is a very small person. I don't know if it, I don't know if it shows in this, in these photos, but he's what, like 5'3", 5'4"?
5'1".
Five one. And I think I'm going to guess that when he started with you, he's probably like what, 170?
He competed the first year. I think he was at, I want to say 159.
Yeah, this is okay. And how much does he weigh here? 190, I would guess.
He was no, he was 177 there.
Oh, he's only like 17 pounds more.
Yeah,
18 pounds. Okay, yep. This it does. Regardless of the weight, this is spectacular. Like I said, he looks like he's 190, and this is a dramatic change from what he was 4 years ago.
Yeah,
like you've done. I mean, obviously, it's his training and his hard work, but with obviously with your guidance. So. I mean, it's incredible what you've done with him. So I just want to show people kind of where who we were talking about. And then going back to Nick, Nick is a very caring person. I barely know Nick. We just started doing the podcast together. And he was messaging me for no reason after I pulled out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, man, I hope you're okay. Hope you know, like it's just a very, he's a different kind of person. So I understand yeah, what you mean is. There.
The muscle doesn't match the heart. You know, he has this impossible appearance that he isn't who he is, you know, I think just because of how big he is.
Yeah.
But if you really get into Nick's inner circle and get to know the person that he is, he's got an incredible heart.
Yeah. He said to me one day, he messaged me one day and he goes, do people think I'm an asshole? And I go, I don't think you're an asshole. I don't think people think you're an asshole. You're just a big guy and you're intimidating.
Right.
And I think being on the podcast, because it was related to the podcast. I think you being on the podcast has shown people that you're a nice guy and you're normal and you're funny. And
he's very funny.
Yeah.
Very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, okay. So going back to you, I didn't know you had aspirations to turn pro. I know you trained hard and you love training, but I didn't know that was one of your goals.
Yeah. I think honestly, you know, as a young coach, I think, you know, for any coaches out there that are young, like I think one of the best things that we can do is continue to be our own body of work. And because, you know, and I've had pro wins and I've had a lot of guys turn pro and that's all extremely meaningful things to me, but like, I haven't had that monumental event. So up until that monumental event, like I felt like it was my responsibility in the industry to keep driving my own progress up.
Yeah.
You know, just because ultimately, like I don't feel as accomplished as Chris Aceto. I don't feel as accomplished as Neil Hill. And then ultimately until I get there, I feel like I keep needing improving my own body of work, you know, through my clients and also through myself because I'm young. So like, if I'm young and I'm not walking the walk, I wouldn't be attracted to myself.
Yeah. How old are you?
31.
31. And are you kind of saying that you experiment on yourself, like with some of the things before you tell your guys to do them?
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did the pec tear happen?
That was June 15th of this past year, 2020.
And how is it doing now? Did you have surgery or no?
I did. So it's been 6 months of constant problems. So I had surgery. I had a complete rupture of the muscle. It was all rolled up to here. And then about 90% of the tendon was torn.
Wow.
So they put it all back together. And through the initial surgery process, they should have put a drain in my pec, but they didn't.
Yeah.
So I had a ton of fluid buildup that actually 9 days post-surgery busted out of my incision. Wow. So then I've had months and months of incision issues with getting the incision to heal properly. You know, and a lot of this I'm honestly talking about for the first time, but I had this mindset that I was going to have like that Kobe Bryant mentality to an injury and try to get back as fast as possible and have it be an incredible story. But I think I was neglecting my own body's like biofeedback. So I had this incision that we continue to have to restitch and do all this wet to dry wrapping for months. So finally, my incision did close the end of October. And then the week of Nationals, I was actually in Orlando. I started to develop what to me looked like a hernia in my incision.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got an MRI, went through the whole process again. I had two abscesses, one that was on the skin and one that was in by the where I was reattached. Wow. So somehow through that process of my incision being opened, I got infected in there. So I just had another surgery 2 weeks ago on my chest to clean all that out. They had to re-put a drain in. So now I'm just kind of in this holding period to see if that grows back. And then if it does grow back, I'll have to have a port put in and be on an IV for 6 weeks. So it's been a mess. It's been a total mess.
Can I ask you, is any of that related to you trying to get back too soon, or is it just?
Well, I think it potentially could be, you know, like I had to really kind of, I don't know if it's like lay down like the, my mental approach to training or lay down my mental approach to trying to improve. But the only thing that I've done through this process, other than like the initial 10 days post-surgery, but I've tried to always be proactive in rehabbing myself and doing cardio. And when this happened and I was told I was going to have surgery again, I just had like a real, you know, conversation with myself. And I was like, okay, the only thing I've not done is I've not truly rested. You know, so once I was told I was going to have surgery, since November, I've just rested, in hopes of not being, you know, basically to my own demise of causing something worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any, are you doing anything? Like, are you training legs at all? Or are you just completely just nothing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess
just, after, for me, it's very hard for me just to go through the motions. And I might tell myself that I'm going to go through the motions, but 20 minutes into the workout, I'm no longer going through the motions.
I know.
Or I'm training with Nick and then all of a sudden everything turns into a competition and it just, it's hard. You know, it's very hard for me to just kind of just be that way.
So I've seen some of your training. You're not Nick's size, obviously, but you're very strong. So is that kind of what you guys do? Is that part of your bond? Is you guys?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I miss it. Like he's down here now, like he came down here for us to train together and I've not been able to train with him. But again, I mean, he's taken it like he seems like he cares a lot more about me than him training with me. And it's been good. So, but yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think if you talk to a lot of the younger guys, like, you know, even Ian and a lot of the guys that I've worked with that have reached out for coaching, I think it was because we found that common ground of just really training hard. And I could level with them, like the younger guys, the younger generation of guys, I've seemed to connect very well with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I want to ask you about was the guys you train all tend to have the same, well, I don't know all the guys you train. So I shouldn't say all the guys you train, all the most notable guys that I can think of that you train all seem to have the same type of, the same type of physique and the same type of advancement in the sport. They just, they get this really rugged, muscular look. They get very big. You know, Ian's one of them. Nick is one of them. Obviously Sean Cleary, even though he's a smaller stature person, carries a ton of muscle. What is it that you're doing that's different than other coaches?
Well, I want to say too, Sean does do training with John Meadows. So I want to say that as well.
Okay.
But I think the biggest thing that I do on a week to week basis within my approach is I specifically ask them to see their training. So like, I like to study their training as if I'm studying game film. And then I just try to pick up things where I can improve upon, you know, cause to me, I think what's lacking the most within coaching culture that's internet based is the ability to be hands-on in the gym.
Yeah.
So if I can kind of bridge that gap as best as I can, because to me, I think the effort is where you really can just take off on people, you know, just really over time, just consistently putting in effort in the gym. And two, I think also I want to say, like, you can only do what you've been taught, you know, so hard work to somebody only looks like what perceived effort is within that situation. So if they've never been taught how to work harder, you can't expect that of them unless you show it to them first.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing. Like I really, really harp hard on the, on giving effort, execution, taking pride in that, you know, like viewing training as if like Tom Brady. I mean, Tom Brady still goes out and throws routes. Why is that? Because he can still get better. He's 40 something years old, but he still knows he can get better. And I think if we view training that same way, it just, it streamlines the progress.
So when your athletes send you their coaching or their training, are they just writing everything down in a journal and then kind of sending you a snapshot of it, or what are they doing?
I send the training and then they're sending me actual like sets,
footage of it, what they're doing. So I've had people do that. They tag me in their sets of whatever they're doing, and then what, you'll just critique, you're not training hard enough, you're not going deep enough, whatever.
I send them a voice memo back typically over the training of what they're doing and where they can improve, or if they're doing great, and I tell them that, and then, you know, go from there.
Is that something you do with all your clients, or is that more upper echelon guys?
Everybody.
How many clients do you have?
I have about 120.
So this is a full-time job. This is your full-time. Only this is your thing. This is the only thing you do.
Well, I mean, I own two supplement companies. That's true. So I'm working a lot.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it. 120 clients plus you just started raw supplements, right?
Right. And then Revive. Yeah.
And Revive. And you're also part of Revive. So you're running like,
yes.
Is your wife part of that, or how is anybody else helping you?
So Dominic and I own Raw and Revive together.
Okay.
And then as far as my coaching goes, I made a decision the second month. So when COVID hit basically in the US for us, like the end of March, I had a big drop off in clients from overseas in March. And then I had another big drop off of clients in April.
Yeah.
So I actually hired somebody to basically revamp the whole back end structure of my website, because I was the SEO and all that stuff, it wasn't really flowing as it should. So that's really, really helped my business a lot, because basically the search engine that my website was on, if you search my name, it wasn't pulling up, it wasn't getting out to people.
Sure.
So that's made a big difference for me. But time management for me is huge. You know, I work a lot, you know, like for example, yesterday I woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. I had an appointment first thing in the morning, and then I was doing updates pretty much from 9 until 6. Yeah. I spent from 6 to 8:30 with my boys. I tucked them in, and then I worked from 8:30 to 11:30, and then went to bed. So that's what a lot of my days look like right now.
How many, you have two kids?
Two kids. Yeah. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old.
I can't, most people, you know, it's funny. Most people say, I don't have time to go to the gym. I don't have time to do this. I have one supplement company, not two. And I don't coach, but I have the podcast and some other things going on, but I can't imagine the workload you have and how you like it. How important is time management for you?
It's honestly everything. I'm very thankful for 2020, because I really just inventoried my whole entire life. I found out what I really needed to focus on. I found out things I was wasting my time on. And basically there's a thing called a 618, which is all the hours in a week.
Okay.
How you're, yeah, 618.
What does 618, sorry, what does 618 stand for?
So that's how many,
that's the amount of hours during the week. Yeah. Okay.
So basically you're breaking that down, and I might've just botched that, but anyway, whatever the number is.
Yeah.
We did this breakdown of what my whole entire day structure looks like, where I'm wasting time, where extra time is that I don't realize is there. And then just trying to utilize that as best as I can.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately for me, like, Dom gave me the opportunity with these companies because I want an exit strategy to coaching, because it is so intensive for me. You know, like, one day I want to be able to be a dad, and I want to be able to pick my sons up from school and take them to practice and not have to be on my phone the whole time I'm there. You know, I really want to be present. So ultimately my goal is to continue to improve with these companies, and then just be able to hand select people. Like, I want to run with Nick until he's done. You know, I have obviously Sean and I, we have some big goals and objectives. But I don't need to financially make money from coaching. That's ultimately my goal one day.
Yeah. So I know this is a bodybuilding podcast, but you just touched on something I thought was really important, which is time management. When you did your 618, which I don't think is 618, but whatever, yeah, whatever the hour, whatever the hours in the week are, who cares? The point is, when you were going through your stuff, what is something, because I think this will help people, because a lot of people always say, I don't have time for this, I don't have time for that. What are some of the things that you can point to, if you can remember, that you had to cut out of your life or that you were doing that was wasting time?
Well, for one thing, I've had like this, I think all of us bodybuilders can kind of see this, but I was overly preparing for my training sessions in terms of, it was like a big to do, you know, like mixing my shakes and realizing like how much time, like I would maybe train for 90 minutes, but it was like a 3-hour hoorah every day, you know, so really just trying to cut out that time. Another big thing that I did was I got cardio equipment at my house, which I understand that not everybody can do that. But for those of you guys that can, if you really look at a piece of equipment and what it costs and the amount of hours that it's going to save you over a year, I think a lot of you guys could probably potentially do that a lot easier. Yeah. That was another thing that saved me a lot of time. I stopped doing this on Instagram.
Okay. So wait, let me pick these apart one by one, just so I can understand them more. So when you talk about, I do understand what you mean about the whole 3-hour window of training and for me, sometimes it's 4 hours.
Sure.
So what did you do? Did you pre-mix your pre-workout shakes, or like, how did you make it all faster?
Well, so one thing that I did was I just stopped like glorifying the training window. And basically I just worked literally. Well, another thing that happened was I moved my training into my garage. That's a huge thing.
Yeah.
But I basically just, I worked to the time that I was going to train. I made my shake in 2 seconds, and then I went out and trained, and then I came back in, and it was immediately back into work, and not like this post-workout, let's figure out what I'm going to post and let's cool down. And, you know, all the things that we often do, you know, for those of you guys watching this, I challenge you to look at your time saver on your phone and see how many hours a day you're on Instagram. Your mind will be blown.
Yeah. It's crazy. So, okay. So the first thing, and I do that, like I'll have a pre-workout meal, then I'll sit down. I got to let it digest and I'm not doing anything in that hour there. And then, I know what you, and then when you get home, same thing. I got to update all my, check out all the Instagram stuff, check out all the YouTube stuff. Okay. So I got that. So then, you said the cardio equipment, were you going to the gym and coming home? Is that why?
That was typically my approach. And that again, I mean, drive time, traffic, you're looking at saving 45 minutes a day right there, you know, in most cases for me.
More importantly, I think this is a problem we all have, is how did you stay off Instagram? What did you do? You just said, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah, I just stopped. I mean, I just told myself I had to stop. I mean, it hit me in the face. I mean, at one point it was like at 4 hours a day, you know, and I mean, that's a huge number, but when it's 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, 8 times a day, you don't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. But isn't it important? But this is how I justify that. I feel like it's important for my business to always be talking to fans or and like.
You are correct. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, I mean, like the Gary Vee system works. I mean, his whole philosophy was based off of just, he built his whole business basically off of communicating on Instagram. So I think there's merit to that. But I think what I really tried to cut out was the mindless scrolling.
Yeah.
You know, so being in your messages is very important. I mean, even like you and I, like if I wasn't checking my messages, this wouldn't have happened today, you know? Right. So I think being in your messages is very important. Commenting within your own posts is very important, but just scrolling all day long and viewing everybody's stories, that's mindless.
It can be. Yeah. No, I do agree. Okay. Is there anything else before we move from this topic? Cause I do want to get into bodybuilding stuff, but is there anything else that you notably cut out to make your day run more smoothly?
And the other thing was I started really using the calendar, like a Google calendar, and just being very structured in terms of my day-to-day approach and actually writing things down instead of like waking up every day and being like, okay, what's today going to be like? I've been very structured and timely just to save as much time as I can.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, you obviously have your own business. You work from home and I'm the same. And I'm sure a lot of people now are working from home because of COVID. When you get up in the morning, are you still setting an alarm or do you start working whenever you get up?
So typically my wife wakes up a little bit earlier than me and that kind of starts a wake up process for me.
Okay.
And I try to be up no later than like 7.
Yeah.
And then go from there. So it really depends. I mean, often days I do set an alarm. Something else, I was actually just talking to some friends about this morning. David Goggins, he talks a ton about like planning out your day.
Yeah.
And he says that if you plan out your day and you wake up in the morning to an alarm and you put that alarm on sleep, he said, you've already ruined your plan for the day. Cause you're basically telling yourself what the night before isn't important anymore. So that was something I heard and I'm like, okay, that's going to change things for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of little things like that that can make you better. I find people just don't do them even though they know they're there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's easy to say, I'm not going to hit the sleep button on my alarm, but you get up and you're tired and you're like, ah, fuck it. You know what? Maybe 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you that those things do set the tempo for the day.
Right. So, oh, one more thing, just before we go on. Another thing I went through my emails and I unsubscribed to everything.
Yeah, I do that too.
So nothing in my email, unless it's strictly business related, is what's in my email now. And that saved me a ton of time. Yeah. And then I've color coded like Revive projects, Raw projects, Camp Jansen, like everything's color coded in there. So it's just extremely organized. You know, so when I started this, I actually felt like I was back in college because I had all these work assignments for myself. But like now that the process is there, it's saved me so much time.
It's almost like once you have the systems in place, then everything kind of starts humming along properly.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So let me ask you this last question about this topic. When you are, let's say you're working on client stuff and you give yourself from 8 to 11, I think you said. At 11 o'clock, are you like, okay, it's 11, or do you let it hang over? Like, are you very strict with your times?
No, with my client stuff, it's basically until I'm done.
Okay.
And since something else too, on the topic of emails, I've converted all my client weekly updates to WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And I have the WhatsApp app for my computer.
Okay.
And I absolutely love it. It's really helped my streamline my communication with them. It's easy to view the videos. Whereas like before I was trying to do the video check-in processes with training. Yeah. You're getting people that are saying, hey, you know, my file's too big, this, that, and the other thing. So I had videos coming in everywhere, whether text messages, some on Instagram, some on WhatsApp. Well, now everything's streamlined to WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And the other thing is too, is it's just one constant, I mean, you know, stream of communication. So you're not losing diets and you're not losing previous updates and, you know, hey, let's check on X, Y, and Z next week. It's like, it's all right there. So that also has helped me a ton.
So you have the WhatsApp app for your computer.
Correct.
And that allows you to see like bigger video and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all just, I mean, yeah, I can open it up to full desktop size.
Sure. Moving on to bodybuilding. I want to get back to the size game that your guys are playing. And I don't know if you're purposely playing it, but your guys always put on a ton of mass. You alluded to training before diet. And I think a lot of people point to diet first, but I've noticed a trend lately, especially with Patrick Tour, and now you're saying it. Do you think there's more emphasis that needs to be put on training or diet? I know both are important, but are people...
If I had to choose, I would choose that people put 100% effort into training and 85% effort into their diet.
Okay, explain why you're saying that.
Because I truly think it makes all the difference in terms of progress over time, you know, because our bodies want to find homeostasis. And if we keep driving the threshold so they can't find homeostasis, it's going to have to, you know, take on new abilities to adapt to that.
Mm-hmm.
Versus you can think of so many bodybuilders, or I can name so many guys that are perfect at nailing their diet, but they don't train as hard as they should, but yet they never change.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously if we're talking like the sheer finer percentages of fat loss towards the end, obviously the diet has to be 100%.
Sure.
I'm just saying in general rule, I would rather take somebody that nails the training, that trains like an animal, that's obsessed about making progress, and isn't always fine tuned with the diet.
Do you think that's what a lot of people's problem is now? Because I feel like there's this culture of be careful, don't overtrain, be careful, don't go to failure. Like a lot of this has really come up lately. I mean, the don't overtrain thing is probably a couple of years old, but now there's this whole new philosophy of, oh, don't train to failure. Training to failure is bad.
Right.
And is that part of what's happening and why guys aren't making the gains they want to make?
In my opinion, yes. You know, and I do want to say, like, if we want to talk about like the whole reps in reserve thing,
yeah.
Which Dr. Mike has, I think, taken and really brought to the forefront.
Can you explain what reps in reserve are for people that are listening?
Yeah. So reps in reserve is if you're looking at a set, like a 3 reps in reserve, meaning that you stop the set with 3 reps left that you have to still give, or mm-hmm. 2 reps in reserve or 0 reps in reserve. It's just it's basically a system to put a stopping point on how close to failure you're going to achieve.
Isn't it the same thing? Isn't it the same thing as saying,
like an RPE scale?
It's the same thing as don't go to failure, isn't it? Like,
right. Yeah.
Giving them a number.
Sure.
Yeah.
But within that being said, Dr. Mike, who has basically brought this to the forefront, is extremely, he trains extremely hard.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a podcast with him last week, and you know, he's like, the problem with the system, or what happens is I tell people to, you know, do a 3 reps in reserve, but in reality, they're on a hack squat, they're doing an 8 reps in reserve and they think it's a 3.
That's right.
You know, and I think overall that general concept is what the issue is that people don't really know what true failure looks like more often than not.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just saving. So they're just technically reserving so much.
How do you explain to somebody without actually being there what failure is? Because I find to be, that's the hardest part for me also.
Okay. So this is what I like to do. And this is a little outside the box, but I like to try to bring failure to that person in a way that makes sense to them, or that's safe. So what I tell somebody to do is to get on a spin bike, for example.
Okay.
And I tell them to basically like a modified Wingate. So they start sprinting fast, and then I tell them to crank the resistance up, and then I tell them to sprint as hard as they can until they can no longer move the pedals.
Okay.
And then that to me is failure. So that feeling that then has gone over their body of complete exhaustion within that window of time is failure. And obviously there's an endurance component to what I'm talking about here as well.
Yeah.
But then if you can get them in that mindset of, okay, wow, that's what it feels like, and then get them safe within a movement pattern, over time, just have them replicate that same effort that they just put in on the bike until they can no longer move the pedals. But now you're in a hack squat and tell them to do the same thing. But I think it's important that you do it in a safe manner first. Like a spin bike is pretty much foolproof. Like nobody's going to hurt themselves, you know?
Yeah. So basically you're just trying to get them to know the feeling. before anything.
I think it's really important that you experience the feeling in a way that's safe.
I think most people would attribute that. I guess turning up the resistance would help, but I think most people would fail because their lungs would give out or something like that. That's the only problem I see with the spin bike.
Right.
They might run out of gas.
And you've got to crank up the resistance or else.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
That's a good strategy. So how often, okay. So that's pretty intense. I mean, that's definitely pure failure. How often are your guys going to failure in a, like, is it one set per exercise, two sets per exercise?
I really think the sweet spot, especially with advanced guys, you know, younger lifters, if you guys are listening to this, it's a little bit different, but I would say the sweet spot with truly advanced guys for a leg workout is like 6 to 10 total sets per workout.
Okay. That's what I've heard. So if you're doing four exercises, you're looking at two sets to failure. Yeah. Okay. Is there anything, what about periodization of your training? Like, are you just like, how, let's take Nick for example. And I know he trains heavy. Is he training heavy every week or is it like 2 weeks heavy, 1 week medium? Like, how does it work?
No. So for Nick, again, I think it comes down to communication and then also the athlete really knowing their body. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out within, you know, basically accumulating fatigue within his training cycle. So he's going to get to a point and he's very in tune with, hey, Matt, like I'm really starting to feel beat up.
Okay.
So when that comes, we try to catch it right before it gets bad. And at that point, what I typically do with him is I pull back on the training volume completely, mm-hmm. About by 40 to 50%, or I just have him take an additional anywhere from 2 to 4 days off.
Okay.
So those are the two things I do. So typically when I say pull back on the training volume, I personally, for bodybuilders, I like to keep the load and the effort high. Okay. But if let's say if we're hitting a workout of 10 sets of failure, I pull that back to 5 to 6 sets of failure, but I keep the loading high.
Sure.
And then if that doesn't really seem to help him recover more, then we're going to go into take 3 to 4 days off. We did that cycle twice last year. So basically twice last year, we reduced volume by 50%. Yeah. And then he also took, I think both times it was 4 days off.
So he's not saying to you very often that he feels beat up. If he only did it a couple times.
No.
He
does 2 true rest days every week. Week in and week out.
Yeah.
And he does a lot of, he's doing 4 recovery sessions right now. 2 are cupping sessions and then 2 are massage sessions a week.
Okay. So he's very active in his recovery.
Yes.
And his eating is perfect.
And he also sleeps like a machine.
Yeah. Okay.
Like he has no sleep issues at all.
Why is that?
All during prep. I don't know.
The guy's massive. Every massive guy.
And the other thing is too, and I mean, this is honest to God truth. His blood work is phenomenal.
Yeah, no, he said that to me and I do believe him. He doesn't lie. It doesn't seem like he lies. Like, but it's really confusing that his sleep is good though, because normally a guy that big, they always have sleep apnea.
Now he snores. I'm sure he has sleep apnea.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to have, like, he's never one of those guys that you're talking to and he's just out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, driving in a car, he doesn't seem to nap. He doesn't need naps.
Yeah.
But he's very regimented. By 10:30 every night, he's in bed. By 7 o'clock in the morning, he's up. Yeah, like he's very, very regimented.
So Nick seems like a little bit, I don't want to say meathead, but not, and I don't mean as far as smarts. I mean, as far as like the bodybuilding lifestyle and generally bodybuilders go to bed whenever they want. They wake up whenever they want. They're not very like meticulous like that. But Nick is very on point, like with everything.
Yes.
Is that your influence or is that kind of how he came to you?
That's him.
He's just like that.
I mean, obviously I encourage it, but that is him.
Okay. When he comes to you and he says he's beat up, what does that look like? Like, what is he saying to you? How does somebody who's watching this know when they need to take that rest?
So there's a lot of different ways that this can manifest itself. It can manifest itself in just overly, you know, you feel joints that you typically don't feel. Sleep patterns can worsen. You could go from being hungry and on the same diet with, let's say, drugs the exact same or no drugs involved to all of a sudden you're no longer hungry.
Yeah.
And if this corresponds with hard training, typically that's the culprit. So you got to pull back on the training, let your body truly rest, and then you can drive those levers up back up again.
True.
You know, but for Nick, I think his immune system starts to get compromised. That's one of the first things that he notices, and then his joints.
Okay. When it comes to diet, I worked with you briefly. I noticed there's a lot of variety in your diet. Is that something you do on purpose? Is the variety for micronutrients? Is it for taste? What is the reason?
I just try to get people to enjoy what they're eating. You know, and I like using a lot of fruits, especially in the off season. I like using fruit juices and when the carbs get really high. And then I just like to have, you know, people look forward to what they're eating, because then cravings aren't as big of an issue.
So
if they actually enjoy it.
So when you say, okay, so let's say somebody's eating 400 or 500 grams of carbs, you want them to get 6 or 7. You're going to use fruit juice for that?
Yeah, I like for example, Naked juices, which are extremely dense fruit juices. I love using those with and guys in the off season, just because it goes down so easy.
What's a Naked juice?
It's just a brand. I don't know if you guys have them in Canada, but it's like a brand. And they basically, on the back of the label, it tells you it's got like 5 apples, 20 bananas, 7 kiwis. It's just like super dense.
Okay. But doesn't that fly in the face of the whole fructose is, you know, carbs stored in the liver?
I don't subscribe to that. Yeah, no.
Okay. What about the whole, if you add fructose to glucose, the glucose will absorb better or go to the muscle better? I'm sure that's probably bro science-y way to say it, but.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, when I look at, like, for example, I mean, there's a common denominator, so I'll just keep using it, but Nick eats a ton of fruit.
Sure.
He keeps progressing. His skin's tight all throughout the off season. I just don't see it correlate. You know, like I think it's a source that people can, I mean, first of all, it's healthy.
Yeah.
There's a ton of micronutrients there. It aids in digestion. You're getting antioxidant benefits from it. Like, I just think that there's so many benefits for it to be, you know, quote unquote labeled something that shouldn't be within bodybuilding.
So guys that are scared of fructose or guys that are scared to put fruit in their diet, you're just looking at numbers. You're like, this has this many carbs. I want to put it in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Because so, I mean, we all get to a point where there's only so much rice you can eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a threshold there. And then once you reach that threshold, you're done. It's like you've hit a brick wall.
But I think most coaches, like I've done this before, where they'll start adding denser foods like bagels, or they'll start adding muffins.
I do that as well. Yeah. Yeah. So you but do that too. My typical approach is I go a ton of white rice until it starts. I start getting feedback that they can't handle more.
Yeah.
And then I typically go fruits. Yeah. And then I'll go those denser sources like the bagels, the English muffins, things like that, just to really push them over if we need to push over and fat levels are still in a good spot.
So is your approach just keep the food's got to keep escalating if the person's going to keep growing?
Not necessarily, because I do think there's a point in diminishing returns. Okay. You know, and I'm not one of these guys that makes my diet calls based off of your blood glucose, but I do think it's important to monitor.
Okay.
You know, like if a guy's blood glucose in the off season is trending into the 110s, 120s, like I'm not just going to keep slamming the food down.
Okay.
But to me, I make my food choices and changes based off of their performance or lack thereof, and then what their body fat levels are doing. If their performance is starting to stall, but they're still lean, even if they're eating a lot of food, as long as their blood sugar is going to go good, I'm going to keep driving the food up.
Okay.
You know, but it's those three things. It's performance, it's body fat, and then blood sugar levels.
What tends to go first? Is it blood sugar that goes first, or is it body fat that goes first?
I would say more often than not, it's the body fat, and then the blood sugar starts to trickle off.
Okay. So if somebody's body fat, let's say you've gotten to the point where you have the rice, you have the clean sources, you have the fruit, and now you've added the denser source, or the junk food, whatever you want to call it, that's obviously the first thing you're going to pull back on.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and then typically I'll keep the fruit in, and I'll start to pull the rice back second.
Oh, so you'll leave the fruit where it is
a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. At what point is somebody too fat, do you think? Like, what's a body fat percentage or that you could point to that you'd be like,
well, it depends. So it depends on how they store it. If some people store it like really specific to one area, then I think you need to be more mindful of that. Like if it's in your lower back or if your glutes just really blow out. For me, I kind of place body fat everywhere.
Yeah.
And I find that during the dieting process, those people aren't as hard to diet down as somebody that specifically holds it hard in one area.
I've never heard that before. That's the first time anybody's ever given me that answer. So I am typically somebody who's leaner in the legs and arms, you know, but lower back and ass is like where I store all my fat. So
yeah.
What does that mean? Does that mean I have to work harder at staying leaner than somebody who holds it maybe more evenly?
In my opinion, yes.
So somebody who has pocket, we'll call them pockets of fat, they should stay, it's your recommendation that they stay leaner in the off season.
Yes.
Huh. That's interesting. It's first
time. Because here's the issue that happens. Like, for example, and I'm not saying this happens to you, but for you.
Oh, yeah.
With your legs, you might have to overly diet down your legs because they're naturally lean to begin with to get your lower back in versus somebody that the fat distribution is equal throughout their body. You're not having to overly sacrifice that body part.
Yeah.
It's just kind of all coming off equally.
You know what? That makes a lot of sense because when I worked with Hani, for example, Hani would say to me, we need to double the size of your legs because it's the first thing that's going to go away when you diet. So I worked in the off season to like double the size of my legs and it worked, but you're right. My leg size did come down from when I started to when I got on stage. And I think you're right. I think because I'm trying to get rid of those big chunks of fat in certain places, everything else is suffering. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that means I got to be more lean in the off season, man. That sucks. How much leeway do you give your clients in the off season? Do you let them kind of do it like an 80-20 type diet, or are they very, very meticulous with their diets?
Well, no, honestly, like I'm a huge proponent of the mental aspect of trying to get bodybuilders to enjoy life a little bit more.
Okay.
Like I like to get people's bodies in a place where they can handle cheat days without negative repercussions. Okay. And a cheat day for me doesn't mean going to every restaurant you can and just blowing it out. But a cheat day for me means like enjoying what you eat, certainly eating more food, just having a more relaxed day, not having to be so structured to eating every 2 hours, but kind of like letting your digestion of whatever you eat just dictate the day. I just think that there's so much benefit to that, you know, to an off season, especially an off season structure. If you can keep body fat levels in a place and drive performance up and allow people to actually enjoy those days and possibly give back to loved ones, give back to their significant other. I think it's important, you know, just for the overall structure of what you're trying to accomplish and the people that you're in your close knit group that you're trying to accomplish it with.
Yeah. How often do you give somebody that kind of day, like that mental break?
So ideally, if I can structure it right and I can get their body tuned, which the prime example of this is somebody coming out of a show.
Yeah.
I'll give them one meal a week first, and then it'll go to two meals a week, and then it'll go to maybe four meals within a day.
Sure.
If I can keep that in, and as long as they're not gaining negative fat, I like to do it every week, you know, just have them look forward to Saturday of being like, this is my day off.
Yeah.
Again, Nick's day off, you know, his whole off season was Sunday. He could eat whatever he wanted to on Sunday.
Seems like
it
seems like he doesn't take the opportunity to pig out though.
He doesn't. He still is reserved. Like, for example, this Sunday, he went out for breakfast and had a decent sized breakfast. And then he came over to my house for dinner. And we had like fillets and mac and cheese and potatoes.
Nice.
But he's still like, I was encouraging him to eat more than what he actually ate.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. He's like self-driven. How much of you plays a part in these, in your client's motivation? Do you motivate or are you just a teacher?
No, I definitely try to like build confidence in them. Okay. I don't want to say motivate because I think that's something that's here in the moment.
Sure.
But I really do try to like grow relationally with my guys because I think it's so important, especially when you're trying to chase big goals. You know, I think like for a lot of people, you can not haphazardly win your pro card, but to accomplish like an Olympia title or accomplish even a pro win, I think you really have to be in tune with your guys, you know, to have that happen, especially repeatedly.
That's a good point. Actually, I never considered that. So your part of your coaching strategy is actually to become friends with your clients.
Yeah. I mean, I try to, and that's also the hardest part. Like, one of the hardest parts of my job is losing guys. Like I absolutely hate it because it's like you're losing a friend, whether that could have been over a potential bad result. Especially like for me, to lose somebody that I know that we both put equal efforts in and the result wasn't what we wanted. And there was frustrations after that. It's just, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's definitely a hard part of the process.
Are you the kind of coach that takes responsibility first over the client?
Yeah, I try to.
Yeah.
Obviously I'm not perfect, but I do try to own up to what I do for sure.
Yeah. I've always felt that way. If I had a client that didn't get the result they wanted, I always, even if it wasn't my fault, I always felt like it was my fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we went through some of the carb sources you use. I'm curious about your system. Are you a low protein guy, high protein guy? Do you like using fats in your diet?
I would honestly say that it depends on who's judging me, but I would say I'm moderate to high protein.
Okay.
And then I do like to, bring fats into the diet. I'm always going to be somebody that tries to increase carbs first.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to kind of try to stabilize, basically satiety through the day with fat sources.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for example, like if we're talking like a heavyweight bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Out of a show, go ahead.
I was going to say, before we get into fats, I'm curious what's moderate protein, and is there specific sources, or does it matter? Is it all meat sources, or do you like to use a lot of whey? Like what is the protein of choice?
Okay, I guess. So for protein, what I like to do for protein, just to simplify it, is I try to get their true contest weight and I multiply that by 2. And that's usually where I set protein requirements at.
So you're at 2 grams per pound.
Yeah. Of lean tissue.
I think that would be considered high protein. Cause like Nick, for example, is, you know, 250 pounds on stage. So you have him eating 500 grams of protein.
Well, no, actually specifically for Nick,
yeah,
he's only eating 200 grams a meal of weight.
Yeah.
So we did that specifically for him because we're trying to continue to improve the illusion of his waist to quad and all that. But typically for most guys, I would say I do about 2 pounds per pound of lean tissue, per pound of lean tissue.
This is what I find interesting about that. So there's been a push in the last maybe 2 years, I think, or year especially, where guys are using less protein. Everyone says, oh, you don't need this much protein. You don't need 10 ounce portions. You don't need 12 ounce portions. When I work with Chad, we used to do 12 ounce portions. Like I was definitely doing 2 grams per pound, but that's when I was my strongest. And that's when I actually got the leanest for shows.
Yeah.
And when I present that to somebody who doesn't do the really high protein diets, they always say, no, it doesn't have to be that way. You can do it with the low protein and blah, blah. And I think they're right. You can, but you know, your guys are very thick and very strong and they come in very good shape. Is it the high protein that's like one of the main reasons?
I mean, here's the thing. We could talk like the bodybuilding research all day long. And I think there's like this culture now of people that are just trying to disprove old methods.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not somebody that's negligent to the research, but sometimes I just don't think it needs to be changed. You know, like the thermogenic effect from protein, that's proven.
Yeah.
The muscle wasting effect of basically being able to reserve muscle in a deficit, that's proven. So like, why would you not want those two things present? It's extremely hard to store body fat off of protein. Yeah. And here's the variable that we need to discuss. As long as your kidney health is good, then high protein is not bad.
Sure.
So then why would you not want that? If anything else, it's just insurance for yourself, you know? Yeah. You know, two things I'm big on, I guess you can say that I'm a high protein guy. Another thing that unless it's been proven to me in a specific case with a specific athlete that doesn't work, I love to pull water hard. I still love to pull water hard. And there's a tremendous amount of people right now saying you don't need to pull water at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know?
That's also a new thing over the course of last year. So before we get to that though, going back to the protein. So, you know, the other thing I've noticed is AJ Sims also does very high protein diets and his guys also come in very hard and have that grainy look to them as well. So, I mean, maybe there's something to it because, you know, the looks are changing and maybe it is because of this new, you know, thing where people guys are doing less protein all year long. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think I've seen guys come nasty peeled on low protein. I've seen, you know, but overall, I just prefer that.
Yeah.
And then you asked me about sources. I basically like to use all sources other than egg whites. And the reason why I say that, and I know that's kind of an outlier, is because I've just seen so many issues with digestive issues with egg whites with guys. So I usually remove those first. So breakfast for most of my guys usually starts out with whole eggs and either chicken or steak.
Yep.
And then we go from there. And then the other thing, I do like to use whey. Not everybody can handle whey. So it kind of depends on the athlete and their digestive ability. But when it comes down to like the nitty gritty part of a prep, they're going to be on whole food protein sources and that's it.
Yeah, that's what I kind of preach the same thing. In the off season, I'll do usually post workout, I'll do a whey and cereal or like whey and something like that. So is that where you would put your whey? Is there other times of the day you would put protein shakes?
Typically around either pre-workout or post, most often, or for those people, like, again, like, I kind of just like to know people's habits. For those people that like something sweet at night, I might put it in at night just to kind of ease that crave at that point.
Getting into fats really quick. Do you add fats or do you use fat from food sources? Like, are you doing whole eggs and steak and stuff like that to get the fats, or are you adding like peanut butter, avocado?
That's where I'll start. I
Okay.
typically start with whole eggs and steak, and then from there I'll go to like mac nut oil, peanut butter, nut butter, things like that. And just again, so I would say that I typically try to get the most out of carbohydrates first,
Sure.
and then once I feel like we're in a good place with our carbohydrate intake, then I slowly add the fats in. And then for those guys that really need the food, then I'll start driving everything up from there, both fats and carbs, once the protein is fixed.
I find that fats with fiber tend to really like blunt somebody's appetite. Like for example, like avocado. Avocados have fiber. When I add avocado, it seems to really halt someone's appetite. Whereas if I use olive oil or some type of mac oil or something like that, it doesn't
Goes through
affect,
you quicker.
yeah, it doesn't seem to affect them as much. Is that kind of your philosophy as
Yeah, I
well?
mean, I think the same thing can be said about the fiber content in like oats and nut butter together.
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a like that that's a
Yeah, I
brick
would
that
totally eat
brick.
that.
Yeah, that's like a brick waiting in your stomach.
Yeah.
So are you doing a lot of sweet potatoes? Because we're there's a lot of fiber in sweet potato
No,
too.
I don't use a lot of sweet potatoes.
So on the topic of fiber then, because a lot of people say like, oh, you're not getting enough fiber in your diet when I do like my day in the life type videos. I've always been under the impression that too much fiber is going to slow down my appetite, and I don't want that as somebody who's trying to eat a lot.
Right.
Is that how you set up your clients' diets?
Yeah, I would typically say that all my clients' diets are low in fiber.
Okay, is that healthy?
Well, ultimately, I think it needs to be based off your digestion if you're having healthy bowel movements. But I would say fiber around, and it depends. Like, if you're looking at a guy on 700, 800 grams of carbs, I think one of the issues that a lot of bodybuilders face is if you're eating the typical oats and sweet potatoes and regular potatoes and rice, like, and you're titrating your carbs up to 800, you're also titrating your fiber way up. So
Okay.
typically, as your carbs go up, you need to be reducing the fiber sources that you're using.
Sure.
I would say for a lot of my athletes, I try to keep them around 30 to 45. Now, am I calculating that for everyone? Absolutely not. But I would say, generally speaking, that's where it usually falls.
Yeah, I always just thought like the most thing that makes the most common sense is, you want to get the calories in and out. And the longer something's
Yeah.
going to sit in your gut, the worse it's going to be for you. I mean, that's why most people switch to cream of rice over oatmeal for that exact
Yeah.
reason. So,
I mean, I remember way back, this was like 2011. I was using my main carb source was sweet potato, and it was the worst digestion issues I've ever had during a prep.
me too. I noticed I didn't know this before, but I switched back to sweet potato like a year ago and I was eating it and I was having really bad stomach problems. And I'm like, so I started doing some reading about it. It wasn't just the fiber, it was the sugar alcohols.
Yeah.
There's actually sugar alcohol in, I don't remember which one it is, but there's a sugar alcohol in sweet potatoes that can actually cause gas and bloating and all these other things. So
Right.
anybody who's eaten like one of those diabetic candies can attribute to what sugar alcohols does to you. So I dumped the sweet potato right away and went back to potatoes and rice and, the faster digesting foods.
Yeah, see, I mean, for my guys, it seems to just do better, honestly.
So going back to the water thing, that's actually interesting too, is one of the most, one of the more modern approaches to getting on stage is guys will leave their water in. I mean, Ian just said it this past Olympia. He said he left his water in. He said he barely changed it at all going on stage.
Now, I will say, Ian is one of those guys that needs water.
Yeah, I was just going to say Ian's like kind of an outlier. He's not
Yeah.
the normal case. But
Yes.
with your guys, when you say you like to pull water hard, what does that mean? Are you starting on like Wednesday, Thursday, or?
2 days out is when I basically keep it constant until 2 days out, and then I start to manipulate it. Like, off the top of my head, I think Sean had like 46 ounces of water the day before the show.
Okay. 46.
So that's less than a half a gallon.
46 ounces, less than half a gallon, so less than 2 liters.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not bad. It's not horrible.
Yeah.
Cause I've done day before the show, I've done like 250 milliliters and that's it. Like wow. Chad used to pull really hard. Hani pulled really hard too.
Yeah.
So you're not,
I mean, look at their body of work. Like, I mean, it still works, you know, like that's one of those things. Like, I just don't think that everything, I think that we need to be aware, but like, I don't think everything needs to be changed. And obviously, like you said, Ian is a great example. I think Ian, one of the best looks that we had as a team was at Vancouver in 2018, 19, whatever year that was. I'm getting my years confused, but he had 9 liters of water the day before the show, you know, like we didn't pull it. We didn't even touch it. But he is an outlier, you know, like what I've noticed with Sean in the 5 years that we've had together, every year I pull a little bit more water and every year he looks a little bit better.
Yeah. So even when you have a standard that you really believe in, you still experiment a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's negligent not to.
Yeah. That makes sense. Switching to gear. Do you mind talking about gear a little bit?
Sure. Yeah.
I want to get into insulin and I'm not sure if you're a fan or not. Are you a fan or not of using insulin use?
I'm not a fan.
Okay. I'm not a fan either.
I would say 97% of the cases, I'm not a fan.
Okay. So who, can you explain why before we move on?
Yes. I do not like insulin because I think it creates a false sense of illusion with a lot of bodybuilders in the sense that they're holding on to tissue that they're really not holding. And then you typically, what happens is they pull it during a contest prep and then all of a sudden they're down 8 to 12 pounds and they don't understand what happened. Yeah, okay. So I think it just creates a false sense of fluffiness, roundness. And I would just really rather bank on the fact that it's true tissue. Something else that I don't really like about insulin is I don't know very many people who have been honest with me that have told me that they can train just as hard on insulin as they could off because they feel like that their heart rate is just more rapid while on insulin, even if they're fully covered.
Yeah.
You know, I've just, even with myself, I've noticed a difference. Like, I just feel like this elevated heart rate, even though I know I'm covered.
Yeah. That's funny. I noticed the same thing. I've never actually pinpointed that, but I don't feel comfortable. I guess I could say, like when I'm training, I feel like this, it's like a jittery, like you're going to go hypo, but you're not because you're covered, like you said, with enough carbs.
Yeah.
And you're sweating more. And I get that too. So you just don't, is there ever an instance in which you think it's valuable?
If somebody, take like the skinniest person that you know that literally can eat whatever they want and doesn't put on any body fat, I would say in that instance, it might be valuable.
So for a real hard gainer.
Somebody that like literally you can throw tons of food at them just to kind of help the absorption process of the food. Now, I'm not going to say, I don't want to say that insulin doesn't help shuttle nutrients during a training window. I'm not arguing that at all. I just don't think that benefit over time really carries weight. For example, I absolutely love and respect Milos.
Yeah.
But I think there's this like thought process, you know, like when people talk about insulin, they're talking about mass monsters and all this size. But if you actually look at Milos, he had a beautiful physique, but I wouldn't say he was a mass guy by any means.
No, not at all.
You know? So somewhere along the lines, it's gotten misconstrued through, you know, bodybuilding forms or whatever, that insulin is this thing that just blows you up. When I just simply say to people, like, show me the body of work where it actually happened.
Well, I think
another thing too is the stomach issues.
I think it's the stomach issues is definitely a big part of it, but I think the misguided part on the forums, for example, is guys gain a bunch of weight. They're like, oh man, I put on 25 pounds. And that initial first week or two of being on insulin, like I got crazy pumps, like all these things, but the pumps wear off after your body becomes resistant to it. And most of that 25 pounds is fat and water.
Right.
So, and I think but people always want to use it until they experience that themselves. And then they're like, oh shit, it's not real. But
right.
Why does it have, other than that, it seems to have this, every time you hear about insulin, you hear it's a super drug and it's going to help you gain all this muscle and all that. Is that just from the forums and all these myths of people putting on weight, or has anybody actually done it?
I personally can't name anybody.
Yeah.
that I know of, you know. And again, like, I want this to be, I think Milos has done so many things for our industry. He's still, every time I see him at a show, I love speaking with him just because he's truly like so passionate about the sport. I just think that his initial teachings have kind of just gotten just turned into this unicorn theory over time. Yeah. Whereas it's not even directly from him anymore. It's just like this, like, you know, playing a game of telephone. You know, and seven people down the line, it's just a completely different story.
Yeah.
But you're right. Every person that comes to me that expects something out of insulin is mm-hmm. somebody that hasn't yet used it.
Yeah. 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 Well, it took me, I used it at the advisement of a coach back in the day. And I realized after one off season, I'm like, this is shit. I'm like, it blew up my stomach more than I wanted. And I don't think the thing is this, I always wonder to myself, like, you know, when I talked to John Meadows about like intra-workout nutrition, for example, because that's most of the time guys are using insulin. They're like right before they train, they want to take in a right. bunch more carbs. You know, John cites a study that says, you know, you only need about 40 grams of carbs during training, 20 to 40, depending on your size. And I think to myself, can our body not assimilate 40 grams? Like, are we not using?
Totally can't.
Yeah. So I'm like, why do I need, if that's the case, then why do I need insulin?
I mean, your nutrient uptake, if you're a healthy individual, your nutrient uptake is the highest around training.
Yeah. So that's the thing is I'm like, if we can take it up anyways, if our body's functioning properly, it's almost like guys think if they take insulin, they can take 80 grams in or 100 grams in, it's going to make them even bigger.
Right.
But most guys I know just get fatter. And that's right. actually what happened to me. So I'm not talking about anybody, you know, I'm going to use myself as the example. So I don't know if it's valuable at all. What do you think is the most valuable? Do you think guys are using too much gear?
Like, I think some people are for sure.
Like when your clients come to you and you know, obviously you probably have a questionnaire they fill out. Are the gear protocols out of control? Like, are guys using more than they think they need?
You know, it's interesting. The better quality of the guys that I get, and this is a God to honest truth, the less gear that they're running.
Yeah.
So when I get astronomical gear reports in terms of a consult, when I'm looking at a consult, it's not from top quality, you know, top end people. Yeah. And I'm not just talking about top end pros. I'm just talking about physiques in general.
Sure.
You know, I think that I am not somebody that believes you need to progressive overload your gear like you do food and training. Mm-hmm. I think that we all have a sweet spot. I think that sweet spot is different, but I don't think it's on the extreme high end. And I think once you find that sweet spot, you need to continue to milk those milligrams and then continue to progressively, you know, overload everything else in terms of diet and the training.
It's interesting you said that. So early in my career, I ramped up every year. It would go a little more, a little more, a little more. And then there was a couple of years where I experimented with like a lot, and I won't say the number, but it was not good. But I realized it wasn't good. And I went back. And like you said, I found a sweet spot. That's something I don't think is overly crazy. It's like around 1200 to me is what, like when I was competing is what my sweet spot was.
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting that you say that because I don't, you're right. There's a spot where you can just be like, I can stay here.
Yeah.
And as long as I elevate my training and my food, I can continue to get better.
Yep.
So I don't think a lot of guys realize that. I think they think, okay, well, I did 800 last year. I got to do
950 or 1,000. Yeah. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. And I actually think now that you've said that, it goes back to something, you know, some of the other pros that have been on the podcast have said is milk each level for what it is. Like if you're still getting gains out of 500, stay at 500 for as long as you can.
Yeah.
So is that something you do with your clients? Like you keep them in a certain place?
Yeah. I honestly, if you talk to my clients across the board, I think I very rarely increase the dosages.
Yeah.
Very, very rarely. Cause I just don't believe like you're putting a hormone in your body that's stabilized. Like it's going to do the job. If you're driving the performance up, it's going to do the job.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I just truly believe that.
When you run a cycle, are you running? I've seen some pretty complex cycles, and admittedly mine are never complex. They're like, you know, this drug and run them. And that's, you know, 8 weeks, 16 weeks, whatever it may be. But I've seen some that are like, they start high and they go low and then they go back high. And there's a huge variance in how they're run. Is that something you do or how
I'm very simple.
Yeah. You're like,
I mean, off season for me, typically I like running test MPP and EQ all together.
Really? Can you explain why the MPP and the EQ together?
Just because again, through my own experience and then just seeing the results of other guys, for a lot of people, I don't feel like EQ is enough.
Okay.
But when you combine a little bit of EQ with NPP, I just see really, really good results over and over again. Another drug that I like to use a lot in the off season and in prep is Primo. But the issue with Primobolan is just legitimacy of it. And that's something that I always struggle with is if, you know, I even write that to guys, I'm like, look, if you can't tell me beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is real, like, let's just forget it.
Yeah.
You know, because that to me, that's one another thing within coaching that's so hard is dealing with underground labs and whether the quality is what we expect it to be or what's on the bottle is actually inside the bottle. Like that's a struggle, you know, and having an eye to really determine those things and paying attention to when a cycle starts and what the actual response is and how much is fluid, you know, and things like that. But I've just really found that sweet spot, like 150 megs of EQ, 150 megs of NPP, and just put those together with a stable test base. That might be 750, it might be 1,000, whatever it is. You know, for some guys, it might go up to maybe 1,500. That's extreme rare cases, but
yeah,
I just think it works, you know. And again, like if you view bodybuilding as an athlete and you set performance markers as an athlete should, the drugs are there to support that. That the drugs are not the driver of that. And that's where I think people's mindsets need to change.
Yeah, I agree with that. So when you set that stack, you're like, okay, this is it. These are your three drugs. You're not playing this game with the amounts.
No.
Okay. How do you feel about Anavar in the offseason? Because I was recently talking to Phil Viz, and Phil said that he feels that Anavar can be just as good as Anadrol.
I honestly love Anavar because you can eat on
it. Yeah.
And that's something else I want to say too. Like when you guys, whenever you're doing anything with anabolics, don't let that choice override your ability to eat. Nothing is going to be better than your ability to eat.
Yeah.
I love Anavar off season in prep, but like, for example, if I were to use Anavar, typically I would pull the EQ out.
Okay.
I really, especially for off season, I just like using three things.
Yeah.
Three things max.
Yeah. I agree with that.
And also too, because then you can actually learn of what each individual thing is doing. If you have five things in the mix, you don't know what's doing what.
Yeah. Do you have any athletes that have issues with NPP being an anxiety drug or not an anxiety drug, but causing anxiety?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Cause that's one of my things with DECA. Every time I use DECA, I can feel my anxiety spike.
Yeah.
Like immediately, whether it's NPP or durable.
And then I also have a few guys that are extremely prolactin sensitive.
Okay.
So I just can't use it with them. Okay. I mean, it's like they get gyno flare up like that and then it goes away. But like the longer they're on it, the worse it gets.
What's your, obviously with that stack, you're probably throwing in an antiestrogen. So what would your antiestrogen of choice be?
Typically it's aromacin in the off season just for health reasons.
So like 20 milligrams every other day kind of thing or every day?
Well, like for 750 megs a test, what I like to do is I like to use Novadex so you can get away with even less aromacin.
Okay.
So for 750 megs a test, I would say 12.5 every 2 to 3 days
of Novadex
of aromacin.
Okay.
And then Novadex would be daily.
So you're using both all off season.
Yes.
And that doesn't mess with your IGF or GH or anything like that.
I don't think so because you're putting exogenous hormones in your body.
Okay. Can you answer me one more? I don't want to make this whole conversation about drugs, but I just have one more question. What, I've heard that after a certain level of GH, you're just not going to get anything out of it, whether it be 6 IUs or 8 IUs, whatever. But I've also heard guys using, and this may be a myth because they didn't tell me from their mouth, but I've heard guys using 14 IUs, 16 IUs. How do you feel about that?
Well, so the first thing I want to say is that the more you use, the more risk you're putting yourself at increasing your blood glucose levels.
Okay.
So that needs to be taken into consideration. I will say though that titrating up GH is some of the best results that I've seen with guys.
Okay. What do you mean? What does titrating mean? Like so slowly increasing?
Increasing over time. I would say like a normal max for I'm talking top level athletes with me is 9 a day.
Okay.
So
you're seeing results with guys starting at like 2 IUs and then every week.
Yeah, I would say Yeah, I would say starting at like two IUs twice a day, and then I really a sweet spot for a lot of people, I would say, is six.
Yeah.
And then, but then again, I do see a difference. I for sure see a difference, even if it's just basically being able to maintain your fullness on less food during a dieting phase. I think there's benefit to that alone.
What's the most I've seen benefit from is probably eight, and then anything more than eight, all I've noticed is water retention issues. But is there benefit to doing more than eight? And how are you doing? And how are people doing it? Is it four in the morning, four at night? Is it four in the morning, four post workout? Like, what is this? What is the formula?
With one of my guys, I saw a really good benefit. We actually ran 12.
Okay.
And we did two IUs 30 minutes before every meal.
Wow.
For six meals a day.
That's a lot of work, man. I can't stand that kind of shit where I got to like do a shot every hour and a half or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot, but I did see a benefit to doing that. In terms of fat, this was during a contest prep. So in terms of fat loss and then also fullness while we were pushing the diet.
I've never done that. I've always felt like it would affect something if it was too close or too far from, not too far, but too close to another meal. But I guess
that's the thing. It's a little stressful because your schedule is, it's literally all day long, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be very scheduled, obviously, because you're not doing just a morning and a post-workout. Let's say for somebody normal, what would you do? Somebody doesn't want to do every 2 hours.
Sure. Okay, so for somebody just to get the most out of it, I would do first thing in the morning upon waking, and then I would do post-workout.
Okay, so if you're doing eight IUs or six IUs, just do three and three.
Three and three, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Two and two, whatever you're doing.
For example, for
a girl, if they're going to do one and a half IUs a day or one IU a day, I still recommend that they split it.
Yeah, to get two doses.
Get the most out of the growth out of around the training window as well.
Do you got anybody using IGF?
Not right now, no.
It's too hard to, it seems to be too hard to go.
It's so unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah. We'll switch off of drugs. I want to ask you about your supplement company before you go. How rewarding has it been having your own brand instead of trying to promote other people's stuff that you don't necessarily, I mean, even when I believed in other supplement companies, I always thought there was something else I wanted to add to it. So how does it feel? How does it feel having your own company that you've been able to make the way you want?
It's been extremely rewarding because I truly believe in what we're making. I take pretty much everything that we make every day. Yeah. So it's been fun to be a part of the formulations. It's been fun to bring people into our brand that really believe in our brand. And it's kind of almost like something that I enjoy doing every day that doesn't really seem like work because it's been something that's been a part of like my subculture for so long. Mm-hmm. But yet now I have the ability to say yes or no on things that I think really matter.
Yeah.
And have control of the testing and have control of the third party testing. And that just gives me a real sense of peace about it as well.
Isn't that a really great feeling when you can say you can put together a formula and then test it yourself in the gym and be like, you know what, this needs more of this or needs more of that. And then you get it back and you test it again and you keep going back and forth until finally you have this formula where you're like, this feels amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, if it feels amazing for you, it's going to feel amazing for everybody else. You just have that. Yeah.
And not only that, but another thing, Dom and I, we made this brand, we wanted our parents to be able to take Revive. And my mom has had chronic migraines since I was 9 years old. And she started taking our blood pressure formula, even though she doesn't have high blood pressure, but it helped her migraines. Sure. And then Dom's father only has one kidney,
so
the kidney formula was extremely important. So it's just getting the reports and one of the best things, one of the best parts about Dom and I's day from Revive's perspective is seeing people's blood work. And seeing people's blood work that were like, hey man, this is what my blood work looked like before we used your product. This is what it looks like now. And that's just so rewarding to see.
Yeah. Yeah. That's gotta be incredible. Cause I know it's awesome hearing feedback that, I had a great pump or I had a great this or I had a great that, but hearing somebody say my blood work got better has got to be even more rewarding.
Yeah. It's changing lives, potentially.
Yeah.
So
what is, okay. I know you probably don't want to answer this or maybe don't have an answer for this, but if you had to pick which was your favorite to work on, is it Raw or Revive?
I think Revive will kind of always be our baby just because it was first.
Yeah.
And because we were told multiple times that that we wouldn't be successful because it was just too hard of a space to enter. And we've made it work, you know? Yeah. So like, we obviously care a lot about both, but like Revive was first. Revive was, it's more kind of going against the grain, I guess you could say, in a way, because it wasn't what everybody else was doing at the time.
Yeah.
So I would say that that's Revive would be the answer for that.
All right. Last question you probably don't want to answer, or one of the last questions you probably don't want to answer. Who's your favorite client? Who's your
man? My favorite client.
Can you answer that? You can't answer that one. But who's your least favorite client? Can you answer that one?
I can't answer that one either.
Okay, maybe we'll make it a little bit more diplomatic. Who is your hardest working client? Can you answer that? John's answered that one. I had John on my podcast and I asked him if I was a hardworking client. He literally said, he's like, no, you're not a hardworking client. He's like, I have harder working clients.
Okay, I'll say this. I don't even work with her anymore. But Michaela Acock was probably the hardest working individual I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
What is that? How does that measure up? Like, how do you quantify that? What is it that she did that made you feel that way?
I'm saying this within her doing things with proper form, but the risk that she took and the lack of fear that she had to finish a set on the floor was second to none to anybody I've ever seen.
Isn't that crazy?
She had no problem crawling out of anything. Like,
I've asked that question to so many guys who train with really heavy weight, or I always ask them that question is how, and you train heavy. I'd be, that's something you might have the answer to is where, how do you not be scared? Like maybe I'm more scared cause I've had so many injuries. Cause I was, right.
I'm more scared now and I haven't even gotten back to training yet, but I know it's going to be in my head, you know?
Yeah. Cause when I think back to before I had injuries, I didn't have any fear either.
No.
So yeah. Yeah. Huh. Is there anything any message you want to kind of put out there? I always let everybody kind of give a last message before they go, or anything you want to promote, anybody you want to thank.
Honestly, I enjoyed this a lot. I also want to thank you. I think that you've been an extremely bright spot in 2020.
Thank you,
in
man.
Terms of our industry. I think you're doing really, really great things. I noticed it, right off, I think it was at Tampa was the first show when you did those interviews. That's something that I think it was Tampa.
What interview?
For New York, right?
What I did, Ian and Hunter, stuff, right? Ian and Hunter. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's what I grew up watching, you know, like I'm still such a fan of the sport, and for you to be doing those things, like I really appreciate it. I know a lot of other people do.
That's pretty cool. Man.
Yeah. So I don't have any final say. I enjoyed this a lot. And thank you for what you've done over the past year.
Yeah, it means a lot, man. Thank you very much. It's always great to hear from fans, but it's cool. It's even more cool to hear from peers. So I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Of course.
Okay, everybody. You know what? Check out Matt Jantz's page. Matt, maybe you'll come back another time. We'll talk more.
Absolutely. Happy to have on anytime.
Okay, man. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon.
Yeah.
Okay.